101.9 Hi FM.
You're listening to 101.9 Hi FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review. Welcome to the program. Good to be with you on your favorite current affairs and culture show. Lots to get through in our hour today. We're going to be talking diplomacy, we're talking photography, we're going to be talking a little bit about what's going on in the event space. But I'm happy to say that we're going to be starting the show with a guest, someone who is very articulate. He knows about all sorts of stuff, particularly in the international relations space and in the South African historical space and the African historical space. He actually used to be an editor for BBC Africa. He's a writer and has written a number of books and is an activist and has been involved in political things. His name is Martin Plaut, and he joins us from London today. Martin, welcome to the New Blue Review. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
I wanted to talk to you today. You know, you've been writing a lot of books about history, about South African history in particular lately. And I was particularly taken with your latest one, which is called Promise and Despair. And I think most South Africans will understand things like voting rights, particularly for black people, have been a thing that came around in 1994. But what you write about in this book is actually that there was a point in history where that wasn't the case. So what I'd like to ask is, why did you decide to write about this, and where did you get the idea from?
Well, to be honest with you, the issue came about because it was something of a surprise to me. I mean, I'd worked on South Africa for a long time. I was born there, grew up there, educated there. But it actually came as a surprise to me and, frankly, to many other South Africans that there was a non-racial vote long, long, long before Nelson Mandela. And when I began to look at it, I realized that it actually went back to the 1830s. And in the Cape, there was a vote which anybody could participate in, which allowed people, well, let's be honest, men who had wealth and property to vote irrespective of their race. And that continued right through for 100 years. And it was just something that really got fascinated me. Then I realized that there had been a delegation to Britain to try to maintain this vote when, in the run-up to the Union of South Africa following the Boer War. Now, that there was a big delegation came over with a constitution in 1909 to Britain to try and get a new constitution ratified. That constitution would have stripped away the right of people outside of the Cape to have a vote irrespective of race. And that really fascinated me.
Yeah, it is absolutely fascinating. I mean, people could vote, but were they able to stand for public office as well? I mean, black people.
Indeed. There was absolutely no distinction. Race was not an issue. And there were at least six constituencies in the Cape in which you could not be elected if you did not have the African vote. You just wouldn't get enough support. And this really allowed people to, they took African and colored people, and by which I mean mixed race people's votes, very seriously, obviously. I mean, surprise, surprise, if you can rely on people's votes, you take them seriously. And I'm actually currently working on the biography of somebody who is the very first person of color to be elected in South Africa. His name is Dr. Abdurrahman, somebody who actually came from the Cape. He was a Muslim, an incredible man, went off to Glasgow, becomes a fully qualified Scottish doctor, marries a Scottish girl, comes back to South Africa. In 1904, he is elected to the City Council. And he's on the City Council of Cape Town for 30-odd years. He's then on the Provincial Council. He's held in great esteem. He knows Gandhi. He knows the first leader of the Labour Party, Keir Hardie. So the British Labour Party, I mean. And he is really an extraordinary figure. So people got into began to come into power, and other people began to stand for these positions. And there then came, after the First World War, a big struggle between two forms of nationalism. One was the Afrikaner nationalism, which had suffered so badly. The Afrikaners had suffered terribly during the Boer War, when they were crushed by the British, and really in appalling circumstances. And they were absolutely determined that they would never allow this to happen again. They were going to be in charge of this country that there was now a united country. And they came up against the rising tide of African and coloured and Indian nationalism, which basically said, hang on, we also live here, we also have rights. And these conflicting positions really came up against each other in the 1930s. And finally, the black people of South Africa were actually stripped of their vote. And that is something, I don't know anywhere else that it's happened in the world where you actually had a vote and then it was taken away from you. Democratic rights are quite often taken away from people. But the idea that you would actually take away the right of people to vote was extraordinary. And that's what happened. And first the Africans lost the vote, and then later in the 1950s, under apartheid, the coloured people and the Indians lost their vote. And that was a great tragedy. And it was a turning point, because if South Africa had not gone down that road, then, of course, their views would have been taken seriously, because, as I say, you take people seriously if they have a vote and can elect you.
Yeah, absolutely. The two other things which I found fascinating is probably only I could think of the Jim Crow laws in the south of America, where you think about people being stripped of the vote, even though they were technically allowed to. There were all these obstacles put in their way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the other aspect which I thought was fascinating is it's the only time in history when black South Africans were actually able to vote for their representatives at a national level directly, because of course in South Africa today we have a proportional representation system, so you vote for the party, but then it was a constituency system, so you really had the people deciding who they were going to be represented at, which it's interesting given some of the current debates we have in South Africa about how do you keep electoral officials accountable, that this was already a model that was then being used 200 years ago.
Oh, you're absolutely right. There's also one other thing which is, quite, I don't know, it's sort of a slightly amusing footnote to all of this, is that, Cecil Rhodes, the great imperialist, the conqueror of Rhodesia, the man who thought there should be British rule from the Cape to Cairo, was at this period actually somebody who supported the rights of black people to have the vote. And his was the left-wing position. I mean, it's something that people don't understand because, there's been a big campaign. They got rid of his statue in Cape Town. They tried to get rid of his statue in Oxford. But actually, at this period, he actually was the person who stood for the right of black people to have a vote. His position was that all civilized men south of the Limpopo should have the vote. And by civilized, he just meant that you should have wealth, property, and ability to read and write, irrespective of color. Whereas there were a lot of other people who just said, no, only white people should have the vote. So it's, there are all sorts of historical anomalies.
It's interesting for me, Martin, your book, I think about some books that have been written about the land question recently by some academics, people writing suddenly biographies about smuts. For me, it's interesting that these are all characters that came before apartheid. Do you think that South Africans are kind of done with the apartheid story? Are we digging a little bit further back into our history to kind of figure out who we are and what we are?
Well, I think we have to, because there's one of the things that has been a mistake in a sense in the way that we've conceived of the apartheid story is that it's portrayed now as a fight between two peoples, between the National Party, which was the Afrikaner Party, the White Party, the White Racist Party, and the African National Congress. And basically, it is seen as these two giants slugging it out. And that was certainly true. But when one goes back further in history, one begins to unearth what is a much more complicated history, where all sorts of other figures, other movements, other organizations came up and really played a major role. And of course, we shouldn't forget that, even in the 1970s and 80s, there were all sorts of other organizations like Black Consciousness Movement of Steve Biko, you know, that also played a big role in trying to oppose, you know, racist rule. And of course, they were the predecessor to the current official opposition party in South Africa, the Democratic Alliance, which was called the Progressive Party under people like Helen Suzman, you know, who really did stand up to white rule and said so unequivocally. And, you know, you get all sorts of strange groups that are involved here. I mean, and there's the anomaly, of course, that in amongst the white community, you have this strange situation where almost all the whites who were, not exclusive, but the majority of whites who were opposed to apartheid were Jewish, and the majority of Jews were in favor of apartheid. So you always have that strange relationship as well. It's a fascinating story.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say that. I mean, I'm not sure whether the voting patterns... it's kind of hard to say if you could say the whole Jewish community was in favor of apartheid. Certainly, there was a majority that weren't involved in opposing it. But, I mean, they would like... the majority of who voted United Party, which is certainly not the party of apartheid, even though it was kind of more entrenched in the system than a Helen Suzman or whatever.
Well, I mean, let me. My father was a German Jew who, you know, emigrated to South Africa in the 1930s, and he always told me, you know, it was extraordinary. Within 6 weeks of Jews arriving in South Africa, in his circle, they were treating black people exactly the same way as all other whites did. And he used to say to them, you know, what are you doing? You know, a few weeks ago, we were in Germany. We were all being treated in this kind of way, in this kind of racist, discriminatory way. Oh, they would say, it's different. It's different. I mean, I'm afraid, you know, and to be honest with you, the majority of the white population supported the National Party. And then the majority of Jews voted for the nationalists, or else voted. You're right, voted for the United Party, which wasn't very far away, quite frankly. I mean, you are correct. I mean, I don't have the detailed breakdown of Jewish votes, but I don't think there was anything special about the Jewish community, except that amongst them they had people and they threw up people who were absolutely at the forefront of the resistance to apartheid. And, you know, people like Joe Slovo, you know, and a whole range of them played an absolutely critical role in fighting apartheid, including people like Helen Suzman.
Yeah, certainly one of the Jewish community's favorite relitigation points, if you want to go down that road, Martin. We're talking to Martin Plaat. He is a author and a specialist in international relations and history. And we're talking today a little bit about his books and some of the things that he's written, and we're going to take a short break. By the way, if you want to be part of the discussion, 0618951019, that's the WhatsApp line. And you can also SMS us 34519 if you want to ask him any questions or maybe you've read his books. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back just after this.
From talk to music, from Johannesburg to Israel, from sport to business, this is 101.9 Chai FM.
This is the New Blue Review with me, Benji Shulman, and we're talking today to Martin Plaat, who works on a lot of historical stuff, international relations stuff. He's a specialist in the Horn of Africa, and he's written a lot of historical works, which we're discussing today. Martin, I wanted to talk to you about one of your other books as well. You've written a lot about African soldiers fighting in the Second World War, and I've always found this a fascinating topic of the role of people who are oppressed or, you know, or maybe not completely given their full rights in a host society, then fighting on behalf of that society, and whether that's an effective strategy for people because they gain experience or maybe the admiration of the society, or you learn to use weapons, and what do you think the consequences were for the many Africans who fought in the Second World War against Hitler, but at the same time were facing racism back home?
It's a huge and complex story. Don't, of course, forget that there were black people who fought for Britain and against Germany in the First World War and in the Second World War. in the tens, in the hundreds, thousands of people. I mean, of course, people fought on both sides in the First World War. There were many Africans who were recruited, particularly in the East Africa campaign, who supported the Germans. So you're absolutely correct that there is this strange position of people going in and supporting, in a sense, their own oppressors. And it is something that's not easy to come to terms with. I mean, in my work on the Second World War, what came across to me was very strongly was that people joined for every conceivable reason. There were people who, for example, in West Africa, whom we came across, who were literally surrounded at a marketplace by British troops, put on trucks and forcibly conscripted and sent to the front without any. I mean, sometimes their families didn't know where they'd been captured, what had happened to them, where they'd gone to, and you have everything all the way down to a situation in, for example, in Zimbabwe, what was then Rhodesia, where as soon as war was declared, there were some people who literally went to the doors of the British High Commission and knocked on the doors demanding to be taken in to fight Hitler, because there'd been a very strong British propaganda campaign which tried to inform black people what Hitler's rule would mean for them and the position that they would be put in. And, I mean, it didn't pull its punches, you can imagine. It was absolutely graphic about the racism that Hitler, encompassed. And so, you know, there's everything from people being forcibly conscripted to literally being, you know, demanding to fight for Britain. And the underlying hope always was, if we only show that we are good citizens, we will be given good treatment by our colonial masters after the war is over. They'll be grateful to us. And I'm afraid that the reality was that they never were. Yes, they were always passing out parades, and people got the odd
bicycle, you know,
payment out, and the bicycle, the famous bicycle. And there is a possibly apocryphal story that white people, I think it was in Rhodesia, who fought for the British, were given farms, and black people were given bicycles. I'm not sure it's actually true. But this certainly was no sense of enduring gratitude from the colonial masters. For one obvious reason, I mean, you know, if you look at Britain after the Second World War, they had so many things on their plate. The last thing they had on their minds was, you know, how on earth are we going to look after these people who fought for us? They got them home. They gave them a couple of suits of civilian clothing, a few pounds in their pockets, and sent them on their way. But then, you know, you see the Africans assumed they would get a pension,
mm-hmm.
but there wasn't a pension for example, my mother fought for the British Navy during the Second World War. She didn't get a pension. There were no pension. There were no war pensions. They were disability pensions, and they were paid, and were paid to the African troops right until independence. And at independence, Britain gave lump sums to the newly independent countries, which were supposed to go on paying those disability pensions. Many of them soon disappeared.
Very, very interesting. If you're interested at all in this part of history, you can go to the War Museum in Johannesburg, or it's the South African Military History Museum now, and they have a whole section on a guy called Job Maseko, who blew up a steam line near Tobruk in a famous story. Is one of my favorite characters from World War II, and it certainly is interesting to see what people got up to, and how they had to fight racism at home and abroad. Martin, I also want to ask you about one of your more recent books. I think a lot of people in South Africa will be quite familiar with your book on Who Rules South Africa. It was kind of written at the height of the Zuma years, and you were kind of really looking at what was going on and how was South Africa being controlled and where was the power center. Now that we've had a sort of change of administration and given some of the complexities that are now, do you think that your thesis around how power operates in South Africa is still valid, or did it change when Zuma left?
Well, I think the one thing that I would stand by was, in a sense, the conclusion right at the end, which was that democracy is a fragile creature in South Africa. On the one hand, people have huge respect for the constitution. I think there's nothing funnier than seeing Julius Malema, standing in the or sitting in the National Assembly and waving the constitution at Jacob Zuma, and when in a sense many of the things that he asked for go against the constitution. There is a deep sense of commitment to the constitution, but at the same time there has always been this kind of underlying threat that somehow the security services or other forces, maybe even the military, might be called on if the ANC's hold on power was ever threatened. And I don't know whether this is real, but I mean, all the kind of meetings that there've now been in KwaZulu-Natal, which the ANC is clearly so worried about, with Jacob Zuma still fomenting trouble, as I understand it, there are all these strange things that go on. And how many rumors have there been about a coup? A coup and outside plots and goodness knows what, that keep bubbling up inside South Africa. And that is really troubling.
Yeah, certainly. I think we are at a bit of an unstable point. Somebody has said to me that thankfully the public institutions don't always work as well as they should do, so maybe we wouldn't be able to organize a coup, but I hope we never get to that point.
Well, let me ask you one question. When do you think the last attempted uprising was by the army against the South African government?
A lot. I don't know. Bambata Rebellion, maybe?
No. That wasn't.
I suppose it wasn't the army. It was just an uprising. I mean, it's a good question. When was the last uprising? Oh, well, maybe during the First World War or the Second World War before the.
First World War. It was the. I mean, there were threats during the Second World War, but it was the First World War when the Boerter Smuts government tried to go into Southwest Africa, then a German colony, or Namibia today. And there were elements of the army that actually went over to the German side, and there were other elements within the army that literally tried to stage a coup. But as far as I know, that was the last time it ever happened.
It should stay that way.
Indeed, absolutely.
Martin, I also want to ask you about your role in the anti-apartheid movement and how you think that's playing a role in our international relations today. South Africa has this kind of funny relationship with the West, particularly the Americans and some of the European powers, but particularly, I would say, the British and the Netherlands, they kind of have a bit more respect for them because there was a lot of people that were involved in the anti-apartheid movement that kind of kept the links, particularly with the ANC, but the other liberation movements as well. Do you think that plays a part in how the ANC deals with Western powers, with some of its outlook, or do you think that, it's 25 years now and that kind of struggle history is no longer as relevant for them?
Well, I think you're right. There is still a deeply ingrained feeling, I think, in the ANC that, we owe it all to the Soviet Union, the East Germans, who really gave us the weapons to fight. But if you actually look at the reality of how apartheid ended, it didn't end with Umkhonto weSizwe marching into Pretoria with flags flying and all the rest of it. It was overthrown, in a sense, by a combination of many, many, many small activities, and including things like the pension funds in the United States and across Europe refusing to invest in South Africa, that finally persuaded the apartheid government that, frankly, there wasn't a way forward, that, yes, they could rule now, but in the long run they would be finished. And so, in actual fact, the ANC was much more owed much more to the Western support than it ever did to the Soviet Union and the East Germans and the others. But they don't really want to acknowledge that because they don't want to accept that the Umkhonto-ECs was frankly pretty blooming useless. I mean, not because they were not brave. They were exceptionally brave, and they died, and they had terrible suffering, including from amongst their own people. You know, they were badly treated in the camps. But I mean, I'm not trying to suggest in any shape, way, or form that they didn't play a role or that they weren't brave. But at the end of the day, it wasn't the decisive factor. The decisive factor clearly was this pressure, the worldwide pressure, which did actually begin in London, where the headquarters of the anti-apartheid movement was founded. And, I mean, I knew these people well. I mean, people like Mike Terry, for example, who gave up decades of his life. He's hardly known in South Africa today, but he was the secretary of the anti-apartheid movement, who was a man who literally worked for, I think, 20, if not more, years, morning, noon, and night. And he worked with everybody from the churches to the Communist Party to try to make sure that there was a united front against apartheid. And it was extremely effective.
Yeah, it is interesting how people are remembered, particularly on the international relations scene. And I do actually wish that, you know, we have this O.R. Tambo Award for people from the outside who helped South Africa become free, and I actually wish that more people would get nominated for it, so that that kind of history can be brought up. It's interesting, that was very much a feature of the Labour Party back in the day. You know, the Labour Party was the anti-apartheid party in many respects, although later on the Conservatives came around as well. You were a Labour Party member, Martin, you still are. What do you make of the Labour Party today? Do you think that it's, with its present leadership, is still kind of sticking to that mandate, or are we dealing with quite a different party?
Well, just let me go backwards for a moment. I wasn't just a member. I was the secretary of the Africa secretary for the party for about 5 years, running up to 1984.
So you were right in the thick of things.
Sorry?
You were right in the thick of things.
Oh, I was. And if I might just relate a very small incident which happened the very first day I took up my job. It was that I came into the office, and there in my in-tray in the Labour Party headquarters was a resolution which had been passed by the Africa Committee, of which I was the secretary. I had just walked into the job and was going to the International Committee and then into the National Executive. And it said that we should recognize the ANC as the sole legitimate representative of the people of South Africa, and which was the status that SWAPO of Namibia had. And I thought for a moment, yeah, sounds like a good idea. And then I suddenly thought about it, and I thought, hang on a second. If we do this, it means we've got to de-recognize the Pan-Africanist Congress. It puts us at odds with the OAU and the Organization of African Unity, now the African Union, and the United Nations. It also means that if we want to speak to somebody like Helen Suzman, we've got to go and get permission from the ANC, because they're the sole legitimate representative. I don't think we can go down this road. And I raised this with my head of the International Department and with the head of the International Committee. And they were horrified that I was raising this question, but they couldn't see a reason why I was wrong. So they called a meeting with the ANC, and there they came along. And you know, there were four or five of them. And they just said, what on earth are you doing? So I said, look, you know, I'm not suggesting the ANC isn't the most important body in representing South Africa. But you're not the only ones. There's the Black Consciousness Movement, all the trade unions. You don't control them. There's the PAC. You know, it's not for the British Labour Party to make this decision. This is a decision for the people of South Africa in a free election. And they couldn't think of a reason why I was wrong. And they couldn't come up with an excuse, but they were absolutely furious that I had made this. And frankly, I think the fact that the Labour Party wouldn't go along with this blunted their entire strategy. Because at that moment, that was what they wanted. They wanted to get this kind of unique imprimatur, shall we say, of being the sole legitimate representative. And they didn't get it. And, you know, they loathed me from then onwards. And all sorts of rumours surrounding my background, and oh, you know, he's a bit of a dark character, you know, maybe he's maybe he's working for boss and all the rest of it. I mean, that kind of thing. You know, I mean, but there's nothing you can say. You can't prove you're not working for somebody. So it was an unpleasant period for me. But I mean, you know, that's life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think an interesting part of our history. There was a great book written a few years ago called The People's War, and they talk a little bit about this aspect on the political side about soul representativeness and what does mm-hmm. that mean in a South African context. We're talking to Martin Plaut. He is a researcher and a writer and an author, and we're just discussing with him historical and contemporary politics. We'll be back just after the break.
The best part of your day. At the heart of your community.
All the talk.
All the music.
All the news.
Chai FM.
101.9 Chai FM. This is the New Blue Review. I'm Benji Shulman. We're talking to Martin Plaut today. He is an author and a researcher and a writer. And he's written a number of books which you're chatting to him about. Martin, before the break, we were talking about your anti-apartheid movement credentials, your work, and your work in the Labour Party. I did ask you, where do you think the party is at the moment, particularly with some of these issues around anti-Semitism with Corbyn and the sort of kind of far left views he has on nationalisation, which are kind of similar, I think, to maybe Julius. Where's the party at, would you say, at the moment?
Well, shall we say, if I take off my academic hat and assume that one of a party activist, I mean, I have been in the Labour Party now since I arrived in the UK in 1978, I think it was. So it's a long time. You know, I mean, I must be frank with you. I'm not a fan of Jeremy Corbyn, but then, you know, I've never been somebody who backed. I support the leaders of my party because, you know, they elected and all the rest of it. But I've never been a fan. And, you know, the idea that I would go around, you know, singing, "Oh, Jeremy Corbyn" at any gathering, I mean, is absolutely farcical. I would never have done it for Michael Foote or, you know, Gordon Brown or Tony Blair. I mean, you know, I don't go around hero worshipping my leaders. I think leaders are there to be, you know, supported, tolerated and frequently criticized. And frankly, I would never change my position on that. But I mean, you know, to be honest with you, you know, Corbyn has a solid background in, shall we say, opposing apartheid. I mean, on that he has, you know, he certainly has a good record. But then he supported every single left-wing movement internationally around the world. And, you know, I remember him frequently coming to meetings at which I would, at the House of Commons, where, you know, somebody would be holding a meeting on, shall we say, Eritrea or something like that, and he'd pop in for 5 minutes and say, "Oh yes, you have my support," and that was kind of his idea of support. And he was like a sort of a cricket that would jump from one cause to the next. I mean, some causes he has really played a major role in. I don't want to underestimate it, and you know, he's certainly passionate about Palestine. But, you know, does he raise the issue of South Sudan, for example? I don't think so. And I mean, you're quite right in looking at the policies that he is pursuing. Some of them are pretty old-fashioned. They are old-style nationalization of the means of production, sort of old-fashioned Marxist concepts. You know, personally, you know, I don't give a damn whether the railways are run by the state or run by private companies. What I want is a railway system which gets me from A to B at a decent price, is clean and runs efficiently. You know, how it happens, I don't think is particularly important. And I'm just, you know, while there's been, you know, from Thatcherism onwards, there was this huge move away from statist solutions and nationalization towards the private sector, and perhaps it's gone too far, and perhaps we should move back in the other direction. I have no problem with that, but I don't see it as a religion. I think you need to approach these things as a pragmatist, and you know, if the state can do a better job, fine. I have no problem with that.
I mean, given the dog show that is the Brexit negotiations with the Conservatives, I mean, do you think he could win an election? Because he might have to, given what's going on.
Well, you know, since I was wrong about the fall of the Berlin Wall, the election of Hillary Clinton, and just about everything else, I'm not going to predict who's going to win the next election, or even when the election will be. Because, I mean, we are in the most unstable period of British politics that I know since I arrived in this country, whatever it was, 40 years ago. Because, I mean, literally, between now and the end of March, I'd be doing a little poll with people, with my friends. And I ask them six questions. Do you think which of the following will happen? The Labour Party will split? The Conservative Party will split? Theresa May, the Prime Minister, will get some Brexit legislation through Parliament? We'll have another referendum? We'll have an election? And I can assure you that my friends, you know, all right, we mostly sort of North London kind of left-wing people. But, I mean, you know, there is absolutely no consensus on any one of those positions. Nobody knows where we're going. Absolutely not a clue. And that is it's actually quite worrying to be in such a sort of febrile there's no stability in British politics. And British politics has been stable for years. Now it's not.
Yeah, certainly a very interesting time to be looking at British politics. Martin, that's pretty much all the time we have for today. I didn't even get to ask you about your writings about Zimbabwe. I believe that's something that you're working on at the moment. But if people want to check out your books, check out your writings, where can they have a look?
Well, you know, if they just do a short Google search for me, you know, Martin Plath, you'll see the books I've written. Funnily enough, I'm just working on one now, not for a South African audience, but for an international audience called Understanding South Africa. I'm working on that with a South African author as well, and we're going to try and, you know, in one simple book put everything away and designed to come out after the next election. Can you tell me when the next South African election is going to be? Because I'd love to know.
Word on the street is in April, May, but you wouldn't want to predict these things in South Africa either.
I'd better get writing.
Martin Plath, thank you so much for being on the New Blue Review, and please keep up the good work on your history and your politics.
Pleasure.
Martin Plath there, joining us all the way from London. He is part of the BBC and was part of the BBC as a writer and an author, and we were chatting to him about some of the things that he thinks and some of the things that he does. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back just after that.
Stay relevant and up-to-date. Informed. This is 101.9 High FM.
New Blue Review with me, Benji Shulman, on 101.9 High FM. I hope you enjoyed that. And by the way, talking a bit about South African history, we are inviting the whole Jewish community to join us in paying tribute to South African legend and great friend of the Jewish community, Prince Magosuthu Buthelezi, in honor of his 90th birthday. We'll be acknowledging his accomplishments and thanking him for his firm support of our community and the State of Israel. We encourage you all to join us Monday the 8th of October, that's tonight, at 5:30 p.m. at Glen Hazel Shul in Yeshiva College for Mincha prayers, followed by a tribute ceremony. And this event is hosted by the South African Board of Deputies, the South African Zionist Federation, SA Friends of Israel, and is also endorsed by the Office of the Chief Rabbi. There is no charge, however, booking is required for catering purposes. So please do let us know. You can call 011-645-2601, or you can visit the SAZF Facebook page for more details. So, Magosuthu Buthelezi is there, and you should feel free to come through and see a bit of a legend of South African politics. And there's actually so much going on at the moment with the events that are happening. I think we spoke a little bit about it, but this Rock in the Red Zone, which is a movie about Sderot, is happening on the 25th of October, and basically about what's happening over there in terms of the rockets and Hamas and the Gaza Strip and whatever. A really good film if you like to mix rock genres
with rockets. It is a good film. So check out the Zionist Federation for that as well, because that is another event which is coming up. Now, I did want to do a couple of other things other than just do the interview today. And something which I came across, which I just thought was absolutely fascinating, is that there is a new archive photography footage that has been discovered. And I think it's an absolutely amazing story. It's very, very long. So if you want to have a look at it, you can check it out on Haaretz. There's a whole article on it. But basically, there is something called the American Colony Hotel Photography Department Photographic Collection. It's a very, very, very long name. And if you're a regular to Jerusalem, you will know the American Colony Hotel, which was sort of started by a group of Christians that were living in what was then Palestine, in Israel today. It's in the Sheikh Jarrah district, kind of East Jerusalem area. And whilst they were building this hotel and kind of living together in a bit of a commune, they decided that they wanted to basically make a bit of extra money. And some of them were self-taught photographers. And so they started taking pictures of Israel and the people there, and then selling them to tourists and to different people, and also, you know, taking them just for scientific purposes, botany and whatever. And the whole story is about how a large portion of this collection of photographs was lost after bomb blasts and people had stuff stolen and whatever. And for years and years and years, bits and pieces of the archive have been discovered. And there's an amazing story if you go look at it in Haaretz. A large part of it has now been discovered again, and people are looking at it and dealing with it. And you can go look at the story, but there's some great stuff that is sort of available to look at. They have, for example, a fantastic picture of British, Arab, and Bedouin officials having a meeting in Amman. Obviously, that's Jordan in 1921. And it's also in color, which is quite remarkable, because you think about photographs of that period all being black and white. But you have these color photographs and people wearing a kind of traditional Arab and Muslim and Druze garb, but they're standing in front of a propeller plane from Britain and meeting different British officials. And you can see people on the Galilee, and you can see what Jerusalem looked like in the 1920s at the turn of the century, and the old city and some of what was the new city coming at that point. And you can see some of basically what life was like at the time through the lens of these photographers. And it's absolutely amazing. One of the pictures which I thought was absolutely fascinating is a picture of arsenic soaked corn or bran. And the reason that they were soaking bran in arsenic was that there was a massive locust epidemic between the periods of 1915 and 1930, and they were kind of hoping that if the locusts ate the bran, then they would die and not eat the crops. And you know, they attacked the crops in 1915, but you can actually see that these people using the watering can, soaking up the bran, you know, they've got boots on, and it's just an absolutely kind of something you wouldn't think of in the Holy Land, kind of locusts, very Egyptian and Exodus and whatever. And there you have people doing that. There's another one of women making dresses in a dress shop as well. And it's just a fascinating story and a key insight into the place of this collection. So if you want to hear about how they found it and how they managed to get hold of these new pictures, then you can go and have a look on Haaretz and look up the missing American colony photographs if you're into that kind of thing. I think it's a really, really great article, particularly if you like history or photography, which is something we've been doing a lot of today. Which also brings us to the end of the show. Thank you so much for listening. I do appreciate it. Thank you so much to Craig, who's been pushing all the big red buttons, Vusi on the sound, Mandy, who does the production. And thank you to you, dear listener, for listening. We'll be back next week on the New Blue Review.